Hey, Jamie, I've got a question for you.
What do you want, Tom?
Who's on the podcast this coming Friday? Is it someone big?
Boy.
Is it a big one? Shall I bother listening this week?
Yeah. If I was going to say take.
And I would say off.
No.
Your trousers.
No, no. Take.
Me out.
No. Take.
Paddy McGuinness.
No. Take.
Take on me.
Take that.
Wow.
Have a little patience.
But hang on, presumably you haven't got all three of them, have you? Presumably you've just got one of them.
Buddy, we have all three of them on the podcast. They've released a new album. It's coming out. They're going on tour. They talk about the ups, the downs, the lefts, the rights, on everything that happened in Take That.
The ins, the outs.
And they reveal it all this Friday.
Exclusively.
On Private Parts.
That's a big one. I'm going to listen to that.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Pete Strauss, and welcome to this week's episode of The Mediaverse. Every week we try and sometimes succeed to answer the biggest questions facing the media industry today. I'm joined by a god amongst mere media mortals, an untamable talent who will surely go down in history as the single best employee of his generation. It's our senior producer, Tom Page.
Thanks, Pete. As always.
And this week we have a guest in the studio. I'm going to quote directly from your Wikipedia page here.
Oh, shit.
He's an Irish singer, dancer, cinematographer, director, producer.
I didn't write that, I swear.
Writer, presenter, plus actor. He is best known as a member of the pop group Liberty X, and he's also our senior producer here at Spirit, is Tony London.
Hi.
I didn't know you were an actor.
I'm not an actor. I genuinely don't know who wrote that. I swear to God.
Where did actor come from?
I must have got it from somewhere.
But Wikipedia is like anyone can change it. So I have had a few PRs in my time back in the label days, so maybe somebody...
Shall we go through and change it back?
What would you change it to?
If
I was to change it, I'd probably
nice
just...
guy.
I think you're being serious.
I am.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to cross it out now.
Yeah, can you delete that bit as well? What would I change it to? Is that the question? Or what would you change
it to? Oh, you can just get rid of it.
Just delete the page.
It's quite
long. Can you actually delete the page?
I mean, I've printed it out. It's 3 pages worth of info about your life.
And is there anything interesting?
I'd love to know if you read it. That's not real.
I mean, I think it's all quite real. I mean,
Do I need to explain? No, I don't.
What are you going to explain?
Well, who the fuck I am for people who most people won't have a clue.
Yeah, everyone knows who you are.
Everyone knows who you are. You're Tony from Liberty X.
Okay.
Yeah, go on. Explain a little bit about yourself. This whole podcast is going to be about you, but.
So who are you, Tony?
Is it really all about me, or is there anything else being discussed?
No, it's all about you. It's mainly about you.
Well, nice to see you've prepped it really well, lads.
We've put it out your Wikipedia. Yeah. We're
in the detail.
Questions.
This is more prep than we do normally.
Since I started, I've been planning this.
I think I'm a director, if I'm honest. Everything on that page has led towards me being a director. So what is possibly on that page is that I started off as an Irish dancer, professional Irish dancer. And then moved on to being in a pop band. Did I do that next? Yes. And then I did some property development, which I think actually informs my ability to direct.
You did property development?
Yeah.
We can put that in there, on your Wikipedia
nobody
page.
Nobody put that in there. it didn't go particularly well. Well, it did, and then it didn't. But then film came after that. And a directing course. And now I mostly produce, which I'm not sure how that's happened. But if
ever
I was
evolving life of Tony.
Mm-hmm. If I was to change it though, I'd probably just put producer now.
Okay.
Just cross out all the others: singer, dancer, cinematographer.
Yeah, I was a shit singer. I was a mediocre dancer. I
never at the Christmas party, you were a brilliant version of both.
Let's talk about the Irish dancing. How did you get into it?
My eldest brother, got an hour off school on a Tuesday and used to come home with a lollipop as well. I hated school with a passion. I would have done anything to get out of class, even at primary school age.
Yeah, yeah.
So I put my hand up. I was like, I am destined to be a champion Irish dancer. As luck would have it, I was, and so was my brother. So we ended up traveling to competitions together.
Yeah.
Then I started meeting girls at the tender age of probably around 11, 12, and I started getting interested, healthy interest.
I was playing Mega Drive at that point, so.
Yeah, I was well behind.
If you were a good Irish dancer, you could punch above your weight.
Okay.
Does that work in Ireland, being particularly talented Irish dancer? Is that
no? It worked outside of Ireland more than.
Oh really?
Ireland. Yeah. So like you're traveling to British nationals, American nationals, World Championships, which were all in Ireland. But if you're winning competitions, it's a bit like being, you know, it's like a tiny little version of being in a pop band, really.
Yeah.
The girls know your name.
So that was your first taste of fame.
I got drunk on that.
A sweet taste of fame.
And that's why I stayed Irish dancing.
And you performed at the Oscars.
Yeah, so I finished my Leaving Cert, which is the equivalent of the A-levels, when I was 17. And at that time, Michael Flatley had just been sacked acrimoniously from Riverdance. And was suing them, and then as payback, and also because he wanted his own thing, he created Lord of the Dance. So that launched the week after I finished my exams. I got on the train. I remember finishing my last exam, which was science, I believe, and I left a half hour early, and I remember walking past everybody in my class, heads down still. Didn't get a chance to say goodbye to everyone, but didn't really give a fuck. Went home, had some of Mommy's lasagna. I never call her mommy either, so I don't know why I just said that. Had some of mum's lasagna, jumped on the train, I think it was the 6 o'clock train, and straight away got the beers in. 17 years of age, heading off for the first time. And then within 6 months, so I joined that Lord of the Dance troupe, the original one, and then 6 months later we're on the Oscars.
Did you audition for Lord of the Dance, or did you get scouted? Or
I kind of got scouted. I was asked to do the very first performance Flatley did as Lord of the Dance, as the Lord. He chose, I think it was about 10 or 12 lads, and I was one of those lads he chose. I couldn't do it because I was in my school play, and it was the bloody dress rehearsal. It wasn't even the opening night, but it was the dress rehearsal. So I was like 16, 17 at the time, chance to go on, I think Des O'Connor was the show, or the National Lottery.
Des O'Connor.
Wow.
Get flown over, get put up in a nice hotel, paid a lot of money for 16-year-olds. And be on TV, and then you kind of walk into the show if you want it. And I had to turn it down because I couldn't let my schoolmates down. So
you were very young when you got into it. Was that a bit surreal?
It was surreal, but it was also just like a great big party because the 30 or so people that joined Lord of the Dance all at the same time, the original troupe,
yeah,
we were all best mates anyway, and we all, I suppose, unconsciously decided to be in this show rather than the other one. Because we all wanted to do it together, and we're all kind of coming of age at the same time. So it was like me and my best friends and my brother were all joining the one troupe, all expenses paid, round the world tour for 3 years. Are you in?
Of course.
That's basically what happened.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
When I signed,
I'd do it now.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Was fame something you always chased? Was that just kind of a byproduct of the things you liked and the things you enjoyed?
I've asked myself that a few times. I don't think I'd chase. I think it did definitely inform my kind of choices. It must have.
Mm.
To be famous or to be kind of not respected to be famous, I suppose. In Irish dancing, no, because you didn't do Irish dancing to become famous, but then I was getting attention because I was good at it. So I honestly think that I enjoy recognition if it's for something that I'm genuinely good or better than average at.
Yeah.
If I get that for... So in the pop band, for example, where I wasn't a particularly great singer and I was becoming famous for activities that, you know, were average at best, I was really uncomfortable with that, like massively uncomfortable with that. Yeah. If I haven't earned it, or if I feel like I don't deserve it, or if I don't know it, if I'm not a master of whatever the subject material is, I don't feel like I should be held up there. I feel very uncomfortable being held up there.
Yeah.
But then when I feel like I've earned it, then as a byproduct of that work, fame's good.
So from doing Lord of the Dance, you applied for Popstars.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was...
And why did you even think to do that? What was
so,
your,
yeah. Genuinely, I was in Lord of the Dance and I got to lead. Michael Flatley retired and I took over his role and I used to alternate it with another guy. But I got to the point where I was like, it doesn't get any better than this as a professional Irish dancer.
Yeah.
You're the lead in the biggest show in the world. There's nowhere to go from here. The money in Lord of the Dance was decent for my age, but it wasn't what I'd be getting paid in Riverdance. Like, my... compadres in Riverdance became millionaires at the same level. I was never going to earn my millions from staying lead in Lord of Dance. I was never going to defect to Riverdance because it was seen as defecting.
Even for millions, he wouldn't.
Well, at that point, they had their leads anyway.
It was hard to break in.
Play too late. There was nobody knocking on my door offering me $1 million.
Not yet.
Well, I had it in my head as well, anyway, that if I was going to be in a band, I would need to do it when I was quite young.
Yeah.
In terms of self-awareness, I thought, I'm not good enough to be a lead singer, but I'm good enough to hold a tune and be in a band, really interested in writing and producing. Actually, if I could be a good writer and producer without being in the band, that would be probably the ideal. So I left to move to London to chase that dream. When it became apparent, I actually walked into the office as well. I remember this as true as God's my judge. I had to walk into the Lord of the Dance office and tell the production manager and our bosses, basically Flatley wasn't there, I'm resigning, and they were convinced I was going to Riverdance, and they kept on at me saying, just be honest, just tell us, you know, contractually you can't do it, and you know, if you lie to us then we might, you know, all manner of threats. And I ended up just saying, look, I'm just going to be a pop star, I'm just going to come out with it, I'm leaving, I'm going to become a pop star. And they started pissing themselves laughing. You laugh while you fucking want, but I'm going to go to London, I'm going to learn how to write songs, I'm going to write, produce, and I'm hopefully going to release some material. See you later. And then I saw that production manager a few years later, because he invested in a show that a mate of mine was a lead in, and I bumped into him and he raised it. He was like, I can't believe that actually came through, you jammy bastard. It actually came through.
Are you one of those guys that once you commit something, you have to do it? Like, for you, having said that, did you have to achieve that?
No, I think I got lucky. I think in a way, like, you know, Matt's whole thing, you ask the universe and it might respond. Maybe not. I think I've asked the universe lots of things since and it hasn't responded. It's completely fucking ignored me.
Like anything else?
Yeah, like plenty of things. But I won't go into some of them without getting divorced. But the idea of going into music, I think, came from a fairly pure place. I knew I didn't want to remain an Irish dancer, and I knew that I could probably take that on. I'd been a classical violinist, you know, as a kid.
Okay.
Been in an orchestra, felt like I could write a song or learn the bits that I didn't know. So I felt like, yes, I have something that I can probably explore and make a living off.
Yeah.
And then if the rest comes, brilliant. But I feel like I've got something solid there. And then, so I did move to London. Couldn't get anyone to write songs with me. Couldn't get anyone to teach me how to produce. Didn't want to spend 4 years on a degree to then become an engineer for another 10 years, to then get fucking fired by a superstar producer who's claiming the credit for all your hard work anyway, which is what happens to everybody.
Yeah.
So decided being in a pop band is the easiest, it's the fast track to working with the biggest producers and the biggest writers in the business, because they get paid to work with you. So I auditioned for one band, which became Blue.
Really?
Auditioned for Blue?
Yeah. That's a scoop.
They chose Simon. He was.
Have you seen him since and gone, oh, I could have been me?
No, I don't think they're even. I don't think they even remembered.
I walked past them in Soho about a year ago, all together. Yeah. Didn't they all? They've all declared bankruptcy.
Really?
Yeah. They've all declared bankruptcy.
I think all of them have. Yeah. Has to do with all that tax crap, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah. Audition for them, really terrible audition, but I got invited down, so I remember the three of them being in the room, and then I decided, you know what, this pop band malarkey is a load of shit. I was going to go back home and study law, and I had a place at a university in Ireland to study law. My family are lawyers, and I would have been actually perfectly happy with that as well, because I was quite interested in that.
Yeah.
And then my mum rang me and said, right, before you come back, and she was really keen for me to come back, before you come back, I've heard about an audition. You should just go, just so you've no regrets. It's for this TV show called Pop Stars. It's an ITV thing, look it up online. So I looked it up, thought, fuck it, that'll be my last ditch attempt, and I'll go home happy 2 weeks later. And then somehow I got through, I kept getting through these rounds. And I was very, very close to getting cut at one stage, I remember. And that was the point at which I let it slip that I was in an Irish dance show and I had been lead, and all of a sudden I realised that if you make yourself stand out from the crowd, you'll get through the next stage.
Yeah.
They'll give you one more chance. And I started to realise, actually, if you can just get that one more chance, you can keep progressing.
You can turn it into something. Yeah.
So what was the experience of pop stars like, being on a hit ITV TV show? And
the time it was filmed, there was no hit. It wasn't going out live. It was like fly in the wall documentaries.
I remember,
cameras
yeah.
around.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't intrusive. The crew were all pretty cool. You could tell that Nasty Nigel was the pantomime villain. He was actually quite nice when the cameras were off.
Yeah.
It was intrusive, as in there's a camera in your face, and I hadn't really sang in front of anyone before, and I was doing a bad job of some of the, shameful. Some of the auditions I saw afterwards just made me cringe. But it was okay. There was plenty of other people involved, and then there was a sense that I was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
From very early on in the competition, I had a feeling like, I don't know why, but this feels
somewhere.
Like it's going well.
Yeah.
And then I got through to the final 10. At the point at which the show started airing, it became all a bit different. It was like, here's the mugshots of the final 10 in the Sun newspaper. I remember reading it in my local corner shop and thinking, shit, that's me. And the previous week to that, they had shown everyone sing a little bit. And it was actually the first time they showed me singing on the show, I think.
Okay.
So there was no clip of me singing on the show that demonstrated that I was actually able to sing whatsoever. All they ever showed was this dreadful audition. So I felt like this massive paranoia that I was being judged by the dude who owned the local corner shop in Portobello Road. Do you know what I mean? But just
yeah.
this sort of like, oh my God, eyes are on me, I've embarrassed myself. Who would pick me and put me in this
band? Did you worry it was going to almost affect the rest of your career? If that had gone badly in a certain way,
you could have been like Darius. Remember Darius?
He did quite well though.
I think he did West End shows and stuff like that.
He did lots of, and he married a movie star. That wasn't too bad.
Darius sounds great.
Who did he marry?
He married the Natasha something or other. She was like, was she an alien in some movie to do with aliens? She was in I'll find out.
Yeah.
But no, it didn't worry me that it would ruin a career, because I didn't really have one and I didn't really know exactly where it was going to go. It wasn't like I was trying to become a serious artist. I figured I'll be a performer because I've been a performer and I might make loads of money and have a good life doing it, and then we'll see, whenever I become serious about life, we'll see what I'll do next. So I wasn't worried about the future at that point.
What was it like not winning?
I fully expected it, because I never believed I would be in the final band. I didn't do enough.
Did you get an idea before of who was going to be in the final band?
No, I would have picked completely different people. I would have left myself out because I didn't do enough to get in, but I would have picked Kev immediately, the first choice. He had by far the best voice in the whole competition, and he's a good looking lad. I cannot to this day understand why he wasn't chosen. Maybe not as sort of media savvy at that time.
Right.
As the other two lads, maybe that was the reason. He might have been harder to handle in terms of management, but actually he was a puppy. He was like cool to be in a band with.
Yeah.
So they got that wrong. I thought they got the girls wrong as well. I won't go into who I would have picked.
Oh, go on.
No, they've all had good careers.
Will anybody remember this anyway? Any of the listeners?
Yeah, absolutely they will.
I like Kelly, I thought was an obvious one as well, who's the lead singer in Liberty X along with Kev.
Yeah.
I thought that was an obvious one.
Other
than that, I think everyone else was sort of interchangeable. It could have been anyone out of the remaining few. But Kelly and Kev, I did not comprehend how they couldn't have been in the final band.
Was there genuine rivalry between you and Hearsay? Or was that...
That emerged. It emerged. At the start, there wasn't, because they won, and then we were literally cut off. None of them even replied to texts or anything saying congrats, because they were probably told not to.
Right.
But also, at the time... they chose not to, which didn't really matter, because we didn't know them that well. I only met them three times over three weekends during the audition process, so it wasn't
so
like
you were
they were
quite
my
segregated
mates.
It was
well everyone was there, but it's like there was so many people there, like you kind of get to know them but you don't. I wouldn't have considered them friends
if you
all.
Saw them now, would you say hello?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Like you'd have a good chat and everything, but I still wouldn't consider them friends. I don't know them. I don't really haven't spent any time with them.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have expected them to give a shit whether I was in the band or not. But it was afterwards that we decided to form the band and do it our own way and try and get signed. I remember we were trying to figure things out, and we saw them on some TV show or other, and they all got in a line. This stayed with me, because I'm not one for like carrying chips on my shoulder, but it really pissed me off. They got in a line and they did this rowing a boat motion, and one of them said, you know, row your own boat or something. Basically, like, we're just trying to jump on the hearsay bandwagon.
Oh.
Which is fair enough, but at the time, you are number one in the charts. You've just had the dream life handed to you on a plate. Man. And you're speaking through the TV to people who have nothing, who have been branded the flop stars and the whatever. And I thought, you five beeps. Payback is going to be a bitch. Payback is going to be such a bitch. So I wouldn't say that necessarily inspired all the work we put in after that. But in the back of our heads,
did that spur you on?
There was no, not really. Like, we just wanted a life for ourselves. We didn't want a life because hearsay were dickheads at the time. So, but when we did actually manage to get a deal and manage to get number one, I think we went to do a gig in Mauritius the week after, and we heard that hearsay split up while we were on the beach with cocktails, having just been number one. And everyone looked and just went,
that must be pretty sweet.
We all just looked at each other and did this little row on the boat motion and thought, well, look where we're at now.
Yeah, Schadenfreude moment there. Yeah.
who did you end up signing with?
V2. So Richard Branson had to sell Virgin to be able to fight British Airways in court to the tune of, you know, he had hundreds of
millions.
I thought
you were going to say you had to sell Virgin to afford your contract.
And then he was allowed, 5 years later, he was allowed to start an indie label. Which became V2.
Yeah.
And Stereophonics were their main act at the time. They were kind of having number ones. Elbow, who are one of my favourite bands of all time, were on V2. We were pretty much the only pop act. So we went in there with half an album and with an idea as to what we should be doing. The A&R didn't want to touch us because he was quite credible, still is quite credible. Sorry, Malcolm. but Richard Branson said, do it. You know, give the underdogs a shot and make it happen. And they did. Wow. A pretty amazing label. Like, the team there were, you know, we wrote a lot of the tracks and we did a lot of the work, but they did, they packaged it, didn't they?
Yeah.
And they, in terms of the promo, when it came to selling us to radio, they did a phenomenal job.
Great job, yeah.
On TV.
So, 20, you know, being 2016, at the moment, the music industry to me, you know, my background was music as well. Being in the music industry now would terrify me.
Yeah.
Like, what was it like back then for you guys being a part of that?
Just 95% machine, 5% creativity. So get in the back of a van at 5 a.m., go to the first radio interview, repeat. You know, when you're doing, it's just cycles, isn't it? So, like, you do your album recording cycle 6 months of going to studios, meeting someone different who has a four-bar loop for you that sounds just monotonous and shite, and you're expected to come up with a melody and a lyric on top and demo it by 6 p.m., repeat that loop until you finish your album.
Is that how it works?
That's how it worked for us, and that's why most pop albums aren't cohesive. They're just, you're working with different people every day, everyone's getting their little 2 cents in, and unless you're a really dominant force in the creation of the album, you know exactly what you want to say and how you want to say it, in which case you probably wouldn't be, you know, going through this process.
Yeah.
It's very hard to keep the reins. So traditionally it's the A&R then who keeps the reins, because they're supposed to have the master plan and you're their minion and they send you out doing what you need to do. So there's a bit of that going on, but then also there's a bit of us actually knowing that, you know, or having to write the tracks. Anyway, that's the album process. Then you do your pre-promo, you might have a few weeks off, and then you just promo the hell out of it for a year. And that is, every single, you go on a 2 week radio tour, you go to every radio station in the country, have the same conversation with every single DJ and every single radio station. Like, the lack of imagination is just incredible.
Yeah.
By the end of it, you're ready to go mad. You start the infighting because you're in the back of a van for 12 hours a day. And then you do your gigs at night to earn your money because the label can't take a piece of that. Or they didn't back then.
Yeah, that's a huge difference. And I guess when you guys first started, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube weren't things. So it was, you literally have to do the legwork of getting in front of people and being on telly and being on radio. And
the only way to get on radio was by going face to face with them and giving them an interview. If we didn't show up for the interview, they'd say, you're not getting a playlist. So it's always a give and take.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
We had to buy access to the playlist by giving them their interview, by showing up at their roadshow gig in the summer and doing it for free.
Yeah.
That's how it works. You get playlisted if you do the favors. And then, you know, sometimes you just have an incredible track and people will say, yeah, we're going to play it because you've done all that prep work.
Yeah.
So we did that for the first three singles. For the first year, we did that. You know, every day, radio, TV, a few gigs here and there. And then you get your hit and then it becomes a tiny bit easier. But for when I knew that we weren't ever going to become a massive band, it's probably around the time we had our number one and the next single, we still had to go around to every radio station in the country.
They wouldn't just play it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're not up at that next level.
Yeah. Would you want to make another record again? Music something that interests you?
If it was to do with a film, possibly yes. If there's a film that I had directed, maybe written and directed, maybe even edited, and needed a violin-based soundtrack, yes, I would do it. But I don't know if I'm that precious anymore. Like I genuinely believe that the reason I fit in this world is because I've learned how to collaborate.
Okay.
So if I then take all that control back, who am I trying to satisfy? I'm not sure I'm in it for my own self-satisfaction. I think I need that collaboration, number one, because I don't have that faith in my own abilities to the extent that I need to just, you know, express my own voice.
Yeah.
I really sort of enjoy the process of getting somewhere I wouldn't have got to on my own.
What do you think of the state of the music industry at the moment?
I think it's pretty exciting, but that's based on my blinker view. I think if we were a band just starting now and we're a bit more mature,
yeah,
we would A, learn how to own our own social audience, build our own audience and own it. Our audience was owned by V2. When V2 went bust, we had nothing.
Yeah.
We got an offer of a deal from a major label 12, 18 months before we kind of got dropped from V2, and we didn't take it out of loyalty, stupid loyalty really, because they helped break us and we didn't want to walk away from them.
Yeah.
They didn't have the money to take up our option.
But they'll walk away from you.
But 18 months later they walked away from us and they said, well, you didn't really come up with the tracks that we think could be hits, so we can't invest more money. But we should have just walked away. So we walked away with nothing. And now, if that happened, you'd walk away with your audience, your entire audience. I don't see why you even fucking need a label. Like, if you can build 10,000 dedicated followers on your YouTube, on your Twitter and on your Facebook or whatever you want to use, you can gig, you can do an album a year, which has got to make you feel good because you're in control.
Yep.
Sell that direct, and then you can gig to that same audience and slowly build from there for the rest of your life. Control everything. But I think the major mindset change that people need is they need to kind of understand that writing the album and recording the album, the bit that's really creative that everyone enjoys, you need to extend the creativity into the marketing, into the audience building, and you need to own it.
Yeah.
You need to embrace that as an opportunity to communicate with people and be excited by that phase, rather than make your album, give it to all these people who will then exploit it for you and rip you off, and then you never get to really own your audience.
I think it's really interesting, because we had a meeting with Hobby Stewart like a year or two ago, who's a YouTuber, musician, quite like a pretty big following. I think he's got quite a lot bigger since we spoke to him. But he was with Sony for a while, realised they couldn't do anything for him that he couldn't do himself, left Sony, started like Coco by himself. And you kind of go, like, what is that role of labels now, really? If you can build your own audience and set out venues and sell records digitally, what is the role of a label these days?
I think there comes a point in which a label then comes back into the fore or into the frame, at which point you need a machine behind you. And it's worth giving up it's worth giving up a big piece of the pie for that machine to kick in. But you make that decision based on they're buying you, they're buying your creativity and your artistry, but they're buying your audience and access to that audience, and you retain ownership of that. And then also you can make sure, your management can make sure that you're a priority, because we noticed as well, we were a major priority for V2 when we were publicly, if we had failed, V2 had failed. So your Monday morning meetings, when they go through the roster, you are talked about at length. What the hell are we going to do with them? As soon as you drop down that priority roster, you're fucked. That's being shelved. You're still on the list. You're still doing something, but no one's
talking. There's no value anymore, really, to be on the label. It's just...
Yeah, it's pointless. Yeah.
What are the differences between like the reality of being a pop star and the perception of it? Because you getting in the back of a van and being driven around isn't how I imagined a pop star to be.
So the real... If I can answer a different question, like the parts of the life that felt very pop star-y were like, you get back to London, you got a little bit of time to yourself, you can go to any club you want, you can arrange to just walk past the queue.
Oh, really?
You will be brought into the VIP. I always had to be walked past it because no one ever recognised me. So I was always slightly nervous about the approach to the bouncers. Like, who's that dude? Like quite often it would just be arranged, and we had security at one point, so you'd just be ushered through, you're brought into the VIP, drinks are for free, you know, you're getting to meet interesting people. I didn't really get to meet them because I was at the bar really with Kev getting wasted. But there's parts of the lifestyle that were pretty incredible.
Yeah.
We didn't earn massive money, but we earned decent money for our age. We weren't successful internationally, which is why we didn't earn a fortune.
Is that what you need to really kick on?
Yeah, you need to be selling in multiple territories, and then you kind of start printing money, really. It's the touring that we would have earned money on back in the day, and if you're only touring in one country and you can only do that every few months, you hit the same spot and do the same gig, you're limited. So there was parts of the life that were pretty incredible, but I never took the full leap. I think I genuinely think people in pop, you can see when they take the leap. They go from being... I'm a normal person in this incredible situation, becoming a pop star, but I'm still keeping the reins on normality and reality. And then they leap across that divide, and they are very firmly in, I am a star, and I will be a star for the rest of my life, and I can act this way because I'm a star.
Yeah.
And I never took that leap because I knew that my talent didn't stack up, I think.
Did you kind of always know that this wasn't going to last forever?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was very much a tourist the whole time. So I started studying film the month after we were number one, because I was like, this is as good as it gets here. And I was
going to
repeat Lord of the Dance. I was like, this is probably as good as it's going to get, and it won't last. It cannot possibly last. Is there anything else that I'm better suited to? Because there's not going to be a solo career. I'm not the Robbie of this band. Do you know what I mean? Well, at one point I thought, could I be? Could I be the Robbie? Like, you know, Shane McGowan can't sing for shit. But then I was like, I don't love it enough. I just don't care.
Yeah.
I just don't give a shit. Like, I hated writing songs by the end of it, which is the reason I got into it. Because it was like...
You're just churning them out.
You're working with vegetarian butchers. That's not my phrase. Someone else said that, and I've taken it as my own. But you're working with vegetarian butchers. You're creating, you know, sausage meat for them to sell, but they wouldn't eat it themselves. And then you end up just looking at that sausage meat and thinking, ugh, I'd love a salad.
That's a great analogy. Moving on from Nibbity X. You went to New York Film School.
Mm-hmm.
How, why, when, what?
I had always had, well, so when I did my first film course, I knew straight away that this is what I should be doing. In fact, I was quite a little bit annoyed at myself. I hadn't realised that previous to then.
Yeah.
Everything kind of made sense. Kind of figuring out how to use a camera to dance around your subject and use the people who are your subjects to kind of create something, and then music and performance and everything intertwines, and then actually being the kind of person who can get things from people because you're not a dick, you know, or at least that's what I like to think, all started to make sense in a way that I was like electrified by, like, shit, I have to prepare for studying film, however this works. So the way I prepared was I saved as much money as I could. I bought two properties. And I did decent deals on those properties. One of them gave me the opportunity to extend. So I put those plans in place and waited until I had enough money and waited till the band ended. And then the day we said, right, that's it, we're not doing anymore, started the renovations. And the plan was to make a fuckload of money from those two renovations, which were in an incredible area. And I was on course to make a fuckload of money, and that was going to fund 4 years in New York, because it's my favorite city on earth.
Yeah. It's amazing.
If ever you're going to leave and enter a new life and think of yourself differently, it's like, go to that city and immerse yourself in whatever you're going to do. So that was always the dream. And then I did my renovations, and they went tits up because of the crash. I had structural problems that slowed me down, so cash flow issues, and then the crash happened, and I couldn't get out of it. So I watched the profit just disappear, managed to stay afloat. But at that time I had no money to study film. So I was like, this cannot be fucking worse, but what do I do? Luckily enough, I went to an internet cafe. Again, I shit you not, I sat down and said, I'm going to look for a job. I don't know what jobs I qualify for, but I'll have a little nose around. And I shit you not, I had an email from a producer in RT in Ireland, the state broadcaster there, saying, you're probably not interested, but we're looking for a TV presenter for 3 months for a kids show to fill a gap in the schedule. It's low pressure, no one's going to be watching, was pretty much what they're saying. Do you want to do it? And I was like, you know, hell yes, we'll give it a shot. So I did that, and it lasted a year and a half. And in that year and a half, I was able to kind of get my plans together, figure out the money thing. And then in the space of 2 months, I sold my property, the remaining property. I got married, moved to New York, and started my film course.
In 2 months?
Yeah.
Busy 2 months?
It's pretty busy. Good feeling.
How long were you in New York for?
Only a year and a bit. We got pregnant over there, and then realized that passport would be good for the kid, but the cost of raising a kid and bringing a kid up in New York when you're not doing extremely well, if you want to live in Manhattan especially, really, really challenging. So I knew I needed to start work and not fuck about at university for another 4 years. I wanted to start a small little production company. I knew that the best chance I had of making that work was back in London with all the existing contacts I had.
Yeah.
And also just to be close to family when we were raising a family. So we managed to have 3 boys in 1 year, me and my wife.
You get a lot of stuff done very quick. Like,
I'm noticing a pattern.
You just go bang, 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 and then leave it for a year.
I've never been to see a shrink. I'd love to go see a shrink to kind of make sense of stuff. I told
you
you'd come
out a changed man from the podcast. We
should do a podcast, you in a shrink. Just
be interesting.
See what your issues
That'd be are. A great podcast series if people would open up to a shrink on tape.
Yeah, we should do that.
That's interesting. Copyright.
Better, yeah. Copyright, you can't say that now. That'd
be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry, where was I?
Came back.
3 kids. So we had 1 boy. 10 months later, we had twins prematurely. I had no idea we could have twins, but it seems my dad was a twin. We just didn't hear about his brother because he was stillborn. So we managed to have 3, and then, the choice was to have a family rather than fuck about New York for 4 years. And therefore, as a result, I needed to get work again, so I started a little production company.
And the production company is called The Cell Productions.
Yeah, award-winning small business.
What kind of stuff do you do at The Cell Production, or did you do at The Cell?
The first gig I got was, a friend of mine was marketing manager for the Scouts, and she had made this video that she'd hoped would be a viral. And it was terrible, and she said, can you help re-edit this into something? And I had nothing to do and nobody willing to pay me, so I just said, can you, rather than give me a tiny budget to re-edit, can you, like, I'll work for free if you can give me a budget to reshoot. So I managed to reshoot something that did very well for them. It was kind of widely viewed among the scouting network, which sounds a bit but
their most watched video worldwide, and has since aired across the Discovery channels in the
UK. Yeah, so we got free TV spots on the back of it, and it did well. So as a result of that, which was me basically working for free for about 3 months, I started picking up bits and bobs of work. So learned how to shoot, had been editing, and then continued to go to courses. So my plan was 1/3 of my time I would do paid work, whatever I get paid to do. Don't have any standards, just do it for the cash. 1/3 of the time I do passion projects where I probably wouldn't get paid, but I would move myself forward and shoot kind of showreel building stuff.
Yeah.
And then 1/3 of the time I'd be on courses. So I couldn't do my master's in Columbia, New York, but I could get myself to every course, probably with tutors that were equally as good for a fraction of the cost in London. So that's how I divided my time for the first couple of years. Then I realised that I was not earning anywhere near enough. That was basically one third of a job. Yeah, with three kids.
Yeah. And I mean, how did you come to Spirit?
One of my bandmates, Michelle Heaton, and her husband, who's a personal trainer, rang me one day and said, "We want to start a YouTube channel. Would you do it with us?" And I said no, because it wasn't my dream to kind of learn how to master YouTube. Yeah. But I did think they had something. They had a business in them. They still do, but it started on YouTube, and where it goes from here, I don't know. But they had this idea, and I thought there was something solid there, and she's got a big social following. So I heard Matt Campion speak at an event called, it was on Transmedia, which I know is no longer a term, but it was called that at the time in Ravensbourne,
yeah,
in London. And he was on a panel, and he was quite engaging, quite interesting. And then there was a few other people I heard speak, and I was like, okay, maybe I should be thinking about getting a job here because I'd learn so much more. And then I entered a comedy film competition run by Hattrick, myself and the Megan Sophie, you know, the girls, Hef and Fletch.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, right.
And a business partner of mine, Rupert, we kind of co-directed stuff. We did a quick comedy thing for that competition, ended up winning. And Matt and Tom were there that night live streaming it. So I just went up to Matt and said, "You're the guy I heard speak. I'm the winner of the competition.
Give me a job. Give me some money, Matt.
We should talk." Yeah. And what was weird about that night was Dave, you haven't met Dave, right? But Dave was a producer at Spirit at the time.
Yeah.
And Dave has since moved to Australia. What was his nickname? Did he have a nickname?
He didn't have a nickname. But he was a red coat at Butlins.
Yeah, so that was what came up that night. He had been a red coat at Butlins, and he was basically me in the tribute act of Liberty X at Butlins.
That's insane.
And when he left, you came to Spirit, basically.
And I basically
swapped out the fake Tony for the real Tony.
Upgrade.
Yeah.
How many Liberty X tribute bands could there have been?
There was like an in-house Butlins tribute band to Liberty X.
Right.
And Dave played Tony.
Does he look like you?
Not really.
Not really. I suspect that same band also did tributes to lots of other pop acts.
Yeah.
I don't think we were that famous that we had. Although I did hear there was one other dedicated Liberty X tribute band. And yeah, I wasn't too happy. Well, yeah. The guy who was playing me was like, he seemed like a cool guy, and he was very talented. But
it must be a weird life being in a tribute band.
Yeah. Sure,
they do quite well.
Yeah, really well.
I was looking into them the other day. The rates they charge to get them are...
Yeah.
The big ones, like, you know, the ABBA tributes and all that, they're making incredible money.
Yeah,
they're filling out, like, you know, 3,000-4,000 person venues, which is...
Amy Housewine gets a lot of work.
Does she?
Okay, Sis. The Rolling Clones. Honestly, they charge ridiculous money.
Amazing.
Yeah. So what kind of stuff do you like working on now? You're a producer. Is it broadcast? Is it branded? Is it both?
I feel most at home with scripted stuff, where because I have approached everything with a kind of director hat on. If it's written on the page, I can figure out how I would bring it to life, whether it's right or wrong. And I went through a process as well with a directing consultant called Simon Phillips, who has a system, the tools of directing it's called, that breaks everything down really in a way that made sense of the process for me, the process of being a director. So I really enjoyed taking a script and applying that process that I'd learned from going to his seminars. And then, you know, doing as much prep as you can and pre-visualizing as much as you can and trying to understand what the kind of tone and the soul of the piece is you're trying to make, which for branded content there usually is none. But, you know, the odd time that there is, getting on set then and just making it work, because you get hit with all manner of shite and things going wrong. And it doesn't matter, you have to make the best decision on the fly and still bring it to life.
So you think that process works whatever content you're making? Because in Spirit, you know, we make a lot of short form, digital, most broadcast. Do you think like the same process for you applies to whatever you're making?
I think it could do. Like, if it's not scripted, then it's like, how do you get it to a point at which, I suppose, the brief is so clear that you know beat for beat what you're shooting?
Yeah.
And then how do you know instinctively that you're not getting what you need in the moment and give the right note to adjust so that you start getting what you need? So yeah, that part of the process is probably is the same. And it comes back to gut and a bit of experience, really. But when we're doing like branded content where it's kind of social video that doesn't necessarily have a story at the heart of it, that's where I'm probably not, I don't add as much value, I think, because it doesn't, I can't get my mitts into the story arc or the character development, and therefore I'm a little bit lost as to what the point is.
Yeah.
And I know there is a point, but sometimes I just don't give a shit about it enough. So it's
That's quite an interesting point, because I'm getting the mindset that all content at the heart should have a story, doesn't matter what it is. And I think where I've gone through a cycle, especially branded content, where that hasn't had to be true. And I do think that we're shifting into a world where that does have to be true now, that actually every bit of content needs to tell a story, otherwise it doesn't have any value in the current space, I think.
Yeah, which makes me feel better about the world we're in, because, you know, I did intend on directing stories exclusively, and then I thought, well, am I doing that at all? But I do think we're moving towards that, and there's exciting things ahead for the people who know our world or get to know it very quickly.
Yeah.
But who also come from that, you know, storytelling sort of background, not background, but they have that storytelling lean or bent or, what am I trying to say? I suppose they just have that, they have that within them, that they inherently want to tell stories that therefore create some sort of human emotion that then has an impact, that then creates the impulse or action that a brand wants them to take. It doesn't have to be a brand, it can be a charity or it can be whoever you're servicing, but if you get that right and you affect somebody emotionally and then they're more likely to do what you need them to do, that's a good feeling.
Yeah. I know when we worked on that as yet unreleased Channel 4 project, you were always trying to find the story in that, weren't you? It was always...
Yeah, sometimes, like to some extent out of fear, because I genuinely fear showing up on the day and not having a clue as to what I'm after and why.
Yeah.
So it's like the fear of not prepping enough, because my confidence is based on mastering what I'm after and then I'm good to go. So the prep is part fear and part the story's got its hooks into me and I'm trying to understand what I'm supposed to go after or what story I need to tell. And then throwing that away has been the hard bit. Like when you get to the shoot, literally burning that little production manual or Bible that you've created for yourself and saying and trusting that it's all in your head and you just, in the moment, get what you can. That's quite exhilarating.
Tony, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Cheers, boys.
Thanks for being on, huh?
Absolutely rabbiting on.
Please subscribe, leave positive reviews and follow us on Twitter at MediaversePod. Like us on Facebook and listen back to old episodes if you haven't already. Thank you for listening.
Okay.
Cheers.
Bye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.